I love it. Can't even hardly see any of you. Seems like it's just right. The stillness of the night. There's something so different about a mass, right, in the middle of the night. That teaches us, right, the stillness. Sometimes stillness is precisely that place wherein God's truths are revealed to us. When all other lights go out and all other distractions, right, are laid away, it is within moments like these, I think, that God comes particularly close to us to teach us about the truths that are meant for us, that have been stored away for us from all eternity to be received by us, and even tonight to be received by us. The story that we hear tonight is a story that we've heard every year since the day that we were born, the Christmas story. And the Christmas story is a story that involves, as you hear me say often these days, not only moments in time that have already occurred, but revelatory of your own life and of mine. You might remember now about a month ago, now it was a long time ago, right? About a month ago, at the beginning of Advent, we walked into a brand new liturgical season, this time of waiting, this time of expectation, this time of preparation. And as part of that preparation, Father Chaz and I wanted to do this kind of homily series on the kerygma, the story of the human race. In fact, not simply the story of the human race, but the story of your life, the story of my life, the story of reality as it is in itself. It goes by many names. And then I had to go and catch the COVID. And so I was sidelined for 2 weeks. And because of my glorious illness, Father Chaz was quarantined as well. And we had to sort of wait on that. But I suppose this has all happened in God's glorious wisdom. Because tonight, when we celebrate the Christmas event, it's actually the perfect time to pick back up on that story, on those chapters. You might remember, if you can recall, all the way from a month ago, that what we do as Christians in coming to know the kerygma, the story of the gospel, we simply become more familiar with the story of our own lives. Your life and my life is completely full of God's meaning. And how we come to know that meaning is through the very word that he reveals. And this is the preface for the entire kerygma, that is your story, the story of your life. The entire preface to that story is that you and I can't actually know our own story unless it's revealed to us. It's the truth. Each of us has a story and a purpose and a meaning that is completely full and altogether good. And we get to learn about our own story because it's the only way that we can know it. And it's the story that God reveals to us. And in this extraordinarily cosmic way that is not merely cosmic and out there, but absolutely and intimately personal, that was thought up and prepared for and remembered from before the foundation of the world. In order to understand that story, we kind of break it down, the entire meaning of your life, all the ways in which you are meant to understand the purpose of your existence. We'll say, as it were, simplify it. We can make it easy. We can make it readily able to be understood and discerned, so that as we walk through our daily existence, we can know what's going on in our lives. When we began that homily series, we told you about the first part of your story. The first part of your story is a part of the meaning of your life that you and I experience often. And it surrounds you. It comes near to you. It intervenes in your life. Any moment, any time that you and I experience joy and happiness and wonder and all things good and pleasurable. You know, when you look at the beauty of a sunset, when you see a friend or a family member that you haven't seen in a while, when you come in experience and you sit down for, and you go through again your favorite holiday of the year, the most sacred rite, like Christmas Eve and all of the good things. When you love your nice cup of, you know, hot toddy, you know, or your nice bourbon whiskey, you know, whatever it is that you celebrate with at Christmas, or the Christmas ham or the Christmas turkey or whatever it is that you have on Christmas, your pies and your sweets and your treats, even all of those things that bring you joy and happiness and mirth, that has meaning. It has purpose beyond the moment, because that purpose is revelatory of God's plan for you. The first part of your story, which is that of joy. The grace of joy is the first part of your story. And what joy in your life expresses principally is this: the goodness of all things that God has made. God is all good. He is completely good. And the only thing that God can do is good things. That's the only thing that he can do. And when you experience God's goodness, you experience that as an emotion of joy, as something altogether good and pleasurable and desirable. And what that tells you about your story is this: that in the plan of God's goodness, his greatest joy, his greatest plan, the culmination of all good things, is nothing less than his plan to exalt the human race unto the dignity of the divine. That is joy. That is what joy teaches you. That is the meaning of joy in your life. What it reveals to you is that God's plan for you is to bring you even unto his own life and to make you a partaker of his own divinity, to place you above the angels who are at your service in God's loving providence. And in your life, right, every experience of goodness is nothing other than that. That is its meaning. That is what it reveals to you. God's ultimate goodness for your life. But that is not, of course, we know, the only experience that we have. There is more. And all things in your life are not always jolly and pleasant and rainbows and sunshine. There is in your life and in my life also great struggle and great suffering. And haven't we seen a lot of that lately? It seems to be said over and over and over this year in front of our faces at every turn. Not all things in your life's experience are well. But all of us, no matter who we are, no matter where we're born or when we're born, no matter if we're Christian or not, no matter if we're born into a great family or a family with great struggles, all of us are captive to suffering and evil. Things that we don't know how to explain and that we wonder, we don't even know how it's possible they can exist in this world. That suffering is also a part of your story, and it too has meaning. That is the story of what happened after God's goodness, the story of the fall of the human race. When you and I go through moments of suffering and darkness and confusion, when we experience the weight of sin and anger and evil, and we can wonder, what does this mean? God does not abandon us in that. There is a grace that arises from within that experience as well, and that is called the grace of desperation. And what desperation arises from is this truth, that anything out there that is bad, anything out there that is not pleasant, anything out there that is a confusion, that is not as it should be, does not come from God. It comes from another place. It comes principally from one place, that is Satan, Lucifer, the devil, who is the one who brought evil into your story and mine. And evil, which comes from Satan, has now infected all of creation, which is why evil also comes from our experience of a broken world and from our experience of broken, wounded people. And if you and I are to understand the meaning of anything in this world that is bad, we have to understand this, that it only comes from Satan from a broken world and from wounded, hurting people. That is the origin of evil. That is the proliferation of evil. And what's most difficult about that, and this is where we left off in our story, right? The most difficult part about the evil, the suffering, the confusion in our life is that we have no ability actually to escape it, no matter how hard we try. Because I say to you, you know this as well as I do, that if we actually had within our own grasp the power to release ourselves from the throes of suffering, we would have done it already. We would have. And if it was within our power to escape suffering and sickness, we would have accomplished it by now. There would be no such thing as cancer. And if we had within our own tools the capacity even to escape death, surely nobody would ever die. And yet all of these things are a part of all of our lives as well. Side by side with the good, there is this deeper, darker struggle that must have an explanation. And God reveals to us that explanation. God, in his great tenderness, as I say to you, I promise to you, that was never my intention and it doesn't come from me because I'm a good father and I can only give you good things. But you must know that evil is in this world because one of my creatures, out of jealousy for you, out of envy of my plan for your life, has come into the world to enslave you and to keep you in the shadows of suffering and death. And so when we look into the world, this is also true of our experience, that you and I were born in exile. We weren't born at home. Home is heaven. We were born into exile. We're going to live all of our lives in exile. And if there was no response, no answer from God, no explanation from God about this eviling and suffering, this all of this darkness around us, we would literally have nothing but despair. You know, and here's the thing. You know, and I know, that for all of the good out there, all of the good out there is not in itself enough to replace or to remove us from the evil. And what we experience in our own hearts is this, that in the end, it is not enough simply that evil have an explanation. That doesn't satisfy us. The only thing that will satisfy us is this, is if evil has an answer. We don't simply want to know why things are the way they are. We need to know, is that all there is? In the end, are we simply subject to this government of darkness? All of these things that are not as they are supposed to be, and yet we have no ability to escape them. Now, the beauty is this, of course, right? You sit in a church in this very moment, on this very night, at this very time, and so do I. And the only reason that you and I are here right now is because the bad news is not the last news. And if it is bad in your life, it's not the end. Because God does not simply have an explanation for evil. God has an answer for evil. The scriptures are so beautiful and so direct on this point. Jesus' own disciple, the beloved disciple, St. John, in his first letter would write this, that God appeared to us in the flesh among men for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. That is why God came, to destroy the works of darkness. Because Jesus himself put it quite bluntly. Jesus said that when a strong man guards his palace, his possessions are safe. And that strong man, who is Satan, guards his possessions in his palace, which is the rule of this world, and we are his possession. For he is the ruler of this world and all things are safe. But he doesn't end there. Jesus says, but when a man stronger than he comes to fight against him, he takes away the armor upon which that strong man leaned. and overcoming the strong man, he takes with him the spoils of the strong man. Jesus reveals, God reveals, that the purpose of your life, the grace of desperation, leads to something beyond itself. And the Christmas story is precisely where that leads. Now, the Christmas story, when it happened in the moment, was full and pregnant of prophetic significance, because God, for centuries, was telling his people through the prophets, he was saying, I see you, and I know your plight, and I understand that you are trapped, and I promise that I'm going to come to you. And his people's hearts were begging for this. For hundreds of years, the voice of the prophets would speak this promise. And then, silence. The prophetic voice of God went altogether silent for about 400 years in history. And his own people no longer heard his messengers, who no longer walked in the midst of God's people. But God did come. And in the voice of one who would write a book of Old Testament scripture about 100 years before the birth of the Christ child, God would again speak and predict this moment, this Christmas night. It was written in the 18th chapter of the Book of Wisdom. And in that moment, the sacred writer speaks about the Exodus event, when God's people were freed from their slavery. But it wasn't simply a recollection of what happened. It was also a foreshadowing of what was to come. And they're actually words that are familiar to you because they describe this very night. And I want to read them to you. So beautiful. I actually have them even in our own Christmas hymnody. You may recognize this from some Christmas songs. This is what the author wrote. For when peaceful stillness compassed everything and the night in its swift course was half spent, your all-powerful word from heaven's royal throne bounded, a fierce warrior into the land doomed to destruction. That is what God described his coming to be, that in the middle of the night, as it were in disguise, when the night in its swift course was half spent, the word of God would bound, as it is described, like a fierce warrior into a land that was doomed to destruction. What God would call himself, what God would foreshadow for his people as an answer to their suffering, in order to help them to be freed from the throes of sin and death, God said this, I will be your redeemer. Redeemer is a very specific word in the time of God's people. The Hebrew word for redeemer is this, goel. Now, to use that word, when God uses this word, if you're in ancient Israel, you know exactly what that means. Because the redeemer, the goel, was actually a position of moral responsibility in every Hebrew family, and it fell to the eldest son of a family. The eldest son of every Hebrew family was the goel, the redeemer of that family. And there was a moral responsibility that he had to fulfill under only two circumstances, which were these. If someone in your family was sold into slavery, or even if someone amongst your relatives sold themselves into slavery, for example, because of a debt that they could not repay, or if someone in your family was murdered, under these two circumstances, the redeemer of that family, the goel, had a moral responsibility to do one of two things. It was their responsibility as redeemer either to go and buy back their relative from slavery and to free their relative from the bonds of enslavement, or to avenge their murder. To be a redeemer quite literally meant this. You are to buy back those in your family who are enslaved, or you are to avenge their death. And this is the word that God uses in regards to what he's going to do for his people, because God says, I will be your Goel. I shall be your Redeemer. And the manner in which God would come to answer the sin and the suffering and the death of his people was most glorious to behold. Because this much is true, that God has no rival. There is no battle ultimately between good and evil, because next to God, Satan is less than an atom, right? He's just a speck. And Satan himself knows that in order to keep his possession safe, he can only fight against those who are helpless. Satan's a bully. He only keeps those under his foot who he is stronger than, which is the human race. Satan knows that if he were to fight against God, he would lose immediately, and so he's not going to fight against God. So how is God going to redeem his people? How is God going to come and do battle for his people? This is the secret meaning of Christmas, and in fact, it's a meaning of Christmas that we mostly never hear. Because when we think about Christmas, we think about the fact that God comes as this small baby, right? This Prince of Peace. There's joy. There's gladness. There's hope. But what we don't understand most principally is this, that when God comes to redeem us, his decision to become an infant child is nothing less than an act of war. Because the Christmas event can only be understood finally in this way. The invasion of one kingdom by a stronger kingdom. And in order for God to invade the kingdom of Satan, to come and free his people, to come and avenge their death, the only way that he could do that, the only way that he could tease out Satan, to bring Satan, to convince the devil to fight against him, is if he could convince Satan that he was weak and helpless. And so we have a Redeemer who did not come as what we would think a mighty warrior would be under great weapons of warfare. We have a God who disguised himself in helplessness to avenge us and to invade the kingdom of darkness for the kingdom of light. It's ingenious. None of us would ever have been able to think that up. And yet, this is the Redeemer that we have. And you and I experience this part of our story in any moment that God intervenes in your life and gives you what's called the virtue of hope. The virtue of hope. Joy tells you about the plan of God's goodness. Desperation tells you about the difficulty and the reason for the sin and the suffering and the darkness around you. But what hope tells you is that God has come to make war on your behalf. He who is unconquerable outwitted the devil by making himself appear helpless so that the devil would take the bait. Yeah. And so then on this Christmas night, what we come to know, what we come into this church for, is because we know in our heart of hearts, where we know that we know that we know that there must be an answer. There must be something deeper. Every single one of us in this church has been through what has probably the longest year on record. And if you have not suffered this year, you've been living under a rock. Everybody, everyone in this church has suffered this year. Everyone in the world has suffered this year. And so many walk through the world wondering in something so heavy as the burden of hopelessness, thinking that in the end, I can't escape this, no matter how hard I try. And there is no answer, no matter how much we strive. And why can't we finally get things right and live under the shadow of darkness? But God comes to invade the kingdom of light. And the place where he meets us is with hope. And what Christian hope does is this. Christian hope is not the same as, oh, I hope it snows because it's Christmas. Because I do. I do hope it snows. We need a white Christmas. It doesn't feel right without it. Christian hope is not even this. Oh, that I hope that my loved one who is sick might be well again. Hope means this, that no matter my circumstances and no matter how dark the world may be, hope tells me with complete and absolute certainty that that darkness is not the end, and it can't be. That if it's bad, we're not at the finish line yet. Hope brings the assurance that the invasion of God's kingdom of light will conquer all things in the end and will accomplish the task for which the Redeemer was sent, which is to free you and to free me from the slavery of sin and death so that we will live forever and be like God for all eternity. And you know what happens when we receive that? We exclaim nothing else than the very words of the angels. Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to all those on whom his good favor rests. Merry Christmas.